This is That History Podcast.
America. What is America's destiny? What is best for our nation, our people? What is just? True justice. We have to think about all these things together as a people. To contemplate our future, to live up to our dream, we must have vision. We as a people will revive our nation's commitment to faith, to what our Constitution calls the free exercise of religion, including, of course, prayer. Through prayer, faith can be restored. We as a people are called to a greater purpose than ourselves. We are not only a beacon to the world, but we should be servants to each other, to encourage each other, to help each other, to lift up each other, our fellow Americans, that we may all prosper together. We have to act on faith with the sure knowledge that we are pursuing the right goals and doing the right things. We will build a stronger country by building stronger families. Families are the building blocks of society, of a nation. By turning to faith, we will be the kind of nation, the kind of people God intends us to be.
I am Kanye West, and I approve this message.
That's right. As you just heard, those were the words of one-time presidential candidate and now disgraced pop culture icon Kanye West during his, I guess you could say, short-lived or ill-fated 2020 presidential campaign. I never thought I would lead off a political history podcast with Kanye, but here we are. Welcome back to That History Podcast, the podcast that looks at current events through a historical lens. I am your host, Pete Stamm, a.k.a. That History Teacher on TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. And today we're taking a closer look at a phenomenon that's been shaping the political landscape in America, Christian nationalism. Now, what is Christian nationalism? Well, at its core, this political theory intertwines faith with politics, capitalizing on the beliefs of many Americans to solidify a power base that adheres to an extreme conservative agenda. That's a big word salad there, isn't that? So let's break this down. Christian nationalism is not merely about mixing Christian values with political discourse. It's a movement that seeks to define what it means to be an American, often suggesting that the nation's identity is inherently tied to Christianity. This ideology can be compelling for many, as it offers a sense of belonging and purpose in a rapidly changing world. It can also be dangerous, as strict adherence to a religious doctrine in a secular government can alienate huge swaths of a population who are either non-believers or people of a different faith. Journalist Catherine Stewart expanded on this definition in an interview with a local PBS affiliate.
Okay, so the mindset is basically the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation. Our law should be based on a certain interpretation of the Bible. As you know, American Christianity is incredibly diverse. But this idea that, you know, once we were great and we've lost it because America is insufficiently Christian in a certain way, and we need to get back to that.
Now, this is a huge part of many platforms from conservative candidates in the mid-late 20th century, and it cannot be overstated how deeply influential this has become throughout American politics. We'll see examples of this in a future episode, so stay tuned for that. But Stewart goes on to give broader implications of a Christian nationalist mentality.
The mindset also includes this idea that, you know, we're facing an apocalypse. You know, America's going to hell in a handbasket. And conservative Christians are the most persecuted group in society. And we need a strong man who's willing to break the rules and exact retribution on our enemies, because only a strong man can save us from this apocalypse that we're facing.
Now, Stewart's background very quickly. She is a freelance journalist who's studied Christian nationalism quite a bit. She's seen different examples of it throughout American politics, especially here in the 21st century. So as she notes, this mentality, this notion that America needs a savior to cure what ails it or someone with a firm hand to guide us out of apoplectic times, stokes fear in people. And people look to strengthen power to deal with their fear. Christian nationalism fans these flames and gives people reason to look toward an imbalance of power and government to deal with their problems. It preys on the vulnerabilities of individuals, particularly those who seek solace and certainty in their faith, and by appealing to a shared religious identity, Christian nationalists aim to mobilize support for policies that often go beyond moral guidance, veering into the territory of political control. And of course, one of the biggest ideas here is political control. Who's going to get the most votes? Who can help promote public safety? Who's going to make sure that American culture is what it's supposed to be? But of course, who's determining what culture is supposed to be? What sort of culture is it? Who's included? Who's not included? What rules need to be followed? These are all questions that every political movement tries to answer. Christian nationalism takes a look at it through a more religious lens. So where did this movement come from? What are its roots? Does it clash with our Constitution and its clauses and powers? Well, to answer that, let's go back to the Constitutional Convention, 1787 in Philadelphia, in a hot, sweaty Independence Hall, as we now call it, where the Declaration of Independence was signed, where George Washington stormed out to fight the British up in Boston, eventually driving them out and eventually helping to drive the British out of America. And look at Article 5 of the Constitution. Well, Article 5, as the founders wrote, clearly states that civil officers would take an oath of office, but, quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. This is about as clear a statement the founders could make, that there should be a separation of church and state. And that's a legal doctrine that is consistently held up by American courts despite nearly every challenge. Also at that convention, with a debate between Federalists and Anti-Federalists raging, compromises were struck, and of course one of these compromises we know now as the Bill of Rights. And in the Bill of Rights, which are proposed right away, by 1791 they are all passed, was an amendment guaranteeing freedom of expression. Of course, this is the First Amendment, and everyone cites their First Amendment rights when trying to express themselves, either in the media, through speech, etc. Now, within that amendment specifically are the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause, which expressly prohibit a national religion. The text literally states, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Notice the words establishment and free exercise, giving the names of the clauses. And this, of course, goes along with the other freedoms, including speech, petition, press, and assembly. One more historical note, historians trace this specific freedom, free exercise and establishment, to a Virginia law by Thomas Jefferson, which disestablished the Church of England as the official religion of Virginia, guaranteeing religious freedom for all in the state. And while Jefferson was not directly involved in the convention, of course he was in Europe acting as an ambassador for the United States under the Articles of Confederation, George Mason was there and suggested including this amendment. Now, why is this critical to note? Well, it shows that the founders never intended for the United States to be a Christian nation. And had they advocated for that, they could have left the Church of England in place or possibly substituted it with a Puritan branch of Christianity as a compromise to New England. We know how into compromises the founders were by looking at all the various ones that we find in the original text of the Constitution. Now, this alone really should be enough to quash any debate about America's religiosity, but arguments for a Christian America go back even farther than this. In Caitlin Sheese's book, The Ballot in the Bible, she goes back to John Winthrop, a colonial governor of Massachusetts, who in 1630 set sail with a crew of colonists to found what would eventually become Boston to establish a port city. As a motivating tool, Winthrop told the crew that they would be seen as a city upon a hill, a direct reference to the words of Jesus of Nazareth according to the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament of the Christian Bible. He warned the colonists that all eyes would be on them, so they needed to show that they could succeed even away from Plymouth, Failure was not an option, as this would be a judgment on their society and their Puritan beliefs. In context, this is a fine motivating statement for believers. Who wouldn't want to do their colony and God proud? Success for them meant validation. It meant they would succeed with their beliefs behind them. It would show the rest of America, it would show Britain, whom they left because of persecution by the Church of England, that their Puritan values and beliefs would not stop them from building a new colony or expanding the territory they had. And in fact, the entire New England area tends to expand during this time, thanks to Puritanism and offshoots from people like Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson. When you get Rhode Island, when you have Connecticut developed in New Hampshire, and eventually in 1820 when Maine separates itself from Massachusetts, and of course with Vermont in the 1790s after the country reorganized under the Constitution. So, of course, doing their God proud, building a new colony, and showing people that they could do it with their values was incredibly validating. But then, in history, we see this moment being used as a political tool. And while you can argue that expanding territory and establishing government is political, John Winthrop, in his background while being the governor, is still just trying to use a biblical example here, whereas people who use it in the future, such as Ronald Reagan, try to seem more relatable to Americans and more in line with their Christian values as president of the United States. And of course, while Reagan was not the first to refer to the statement, he definitely used it more than any other American politician. Now, we'll see more from Reagan in this episode and the next one, but let's go back to the idea of the city on a hill. And while we're discussing the rise of Christian nationalism within conservatism, this phrase was used by politicians across the spectrum, including a certain president from the early 1960s, who many are probably surprised to note actually referred to this before he became president.
But I have been guided by the standard John Winthrop set before his shipmates on the flagship Arabella 331 years ago, as they too faced the task of building a new government on a perilous frontier. We must always consider, he said, that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. Today, the eyes of all people are truly upon us. And our governments, in every branch, at every level, national, state, and local, must be as a city upon a hill, constructed and inhabited by men aware of their great trust and their great responsibilities. For we are setting out upon a voyage in 1961, no less hazardous than that undertaken by the Arabella in 1630. We are committing ourselves to tasks of statecraft no less awesome than that of governing the Massachusetts Bay Colony, beset as it was by terror without and disorder within. History will not judge our endeavors, and a government cannot be selected merely on the basis of color or creed or party affiliation. Neither will competence and loyalty and stature, while essential to the utmost, suffice in times such as these.
Now that, of course, is the unmistakable voice and cadence of John F. Kennedy, referring directly to Winthrop and the city on a hill. The context here is a bit different, though, but still motivating nonetheless. Kennedy is speaking to a joint session of the General Court of Massachusetts shortly before he takes office as president in January 1961. And of course, in his home state of Massachusetts, Kennedy purposefully brought up Winthrop's voyage that founded the city of Boston. This defining moment in Massachusetts history would be the North Star of Kennedy's journey. Throughout his campaign and short presidency, Kennedy promised transformative change and a journey that would lift a new generation of Americans no matter their race, color, or creed, to new heights. Winthrop promised his colony a chance to show how their way of life was superior and would promote a healthy colony even outside of Plymouth. The nation and the world looked to Kennedy to see how he would lead and how America would proceed under his watch. While Kennedy was a devout Catholic, he did not use the city on a hill here with any religiosity or theological undertones. Now, of course, Kennedy is definitely hyping himself up here, and he's putting himself on a level of a Massachusetts legend. But that shows more hubris than religious motivations. Considering Kennedy's treatment of his marriage vows, it shows that he's not the most devout Catholic, but he is proud to be Catholic. And yet, he's not letting his Catholic faith define his whole presidency. And he said as much in his presidential campaign to Houston area ministers when he told them the following.
These are the real issues which should decide this campaign. And they are not religious issues. For war and hunger and ignorance and despair, no religious barrier. But because I am a Catholic, and no Catholic has ever been elected president, the real issues in this campaign have been obscured, perhaps deliberately, in some quarters less responsible than this. So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote. When no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and when no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been, and may someday be again, a Jew, or a Quaker, or a Unitarian, or a Baptist. It was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers, for example, that led to Jefferson's statute of religious freedom. Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you. Until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped apart at a time of great national peril.
Kennedy made it quite clear that no religion should dominate America. He even referred to the persecution of Baptists in Virginia as the basis of Jefferson's religious freedom law as a reason to keep religion out of government. Now, this is two times that Kennedy has referred to religion in a past tense in American history, but he's using it more as a source of history and a reason for people to believe that he will not be subjected to the whims of the Vatican or the will of the Pope. He is running to be president of the United States, and he will take the oath of office for defending and protecting the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. He is not taking an oath to be the Catholic president or the president just for Catholics, but he's using a part of his background to relate to others. And of course, America was and still is a mostly Christian nation. The biggest issue for him, of course, was being Catholic. So by relating himself to the Baptists in Virginia who were persecuted by the Anglicans, the people of the Church of England, he's showing that many of these ministers, some of whom are Baptists themselves, could see themselves in Kennedy as people who were persecuted for their religion, and he is promising them that he will not put up with any sort of religious persecution or test. He will, in fact, be a president of the United States who happens to be Catholic, not a Catholic president of the United States. And of course, we see with this Kennedy's clear assertion that a separation of church and state should be the norm, and we see a clear delineation between liberal and conservative interpretation of religion in politics. And while Kennedy did not support this idea, many people at the time did, and they happened to be conservatives. One of them began the insertion of religion into politics by relating it to a very powerful emotion, fear. Of course, fear is a very powerful tool. It can be used to persuade people to do many things they may not necessarily do. Two people who successfully used fear in this way were J. Edgar Hoover and Barry Goldwater, and they were two influential government men or politicians who used fear to their advantage to inject religion into politics in the 1960s in the United States. And before seeing how they placed Christianity into a place of importance in American society, we need to go back and look at church and state and nationalism.
Nationalism, of course, is the idea that your allegiance should be to your country, you know, usually your home country. In America, a great example of this would be the Pledge of Allegiance that children say in schools every day, and that other organizations use as a way to show patriotism, while still swearing that you will defend and pledge allegiance to your country above all others. Now, America, of course, is not the only country to celebrate or promote nationalism, but it's one of the few countries that has allowed religion to be injected into that nationalism in such a way that it could be dangerous or predatory on its citizens. And of course, as the minister, missionary, and professor James Wood said in a landmark article in 1968, this goes way further back than America or even the American colonies. The idea of nationalism, he says, can be connected back to tribalism of hunter-gatherers walking around, wandering for food, wandering for survival, fighting early wars that they would have. And of course, you can look back to ancient civilizations and the rise of city-states and different empires forming, like Sargon, Hammurabi, all the way to Alexander the Great, the Greek city-states, and different parts of ancient India and China. And a large amount of our history is based on different tribes or groups competing with each other for survival.
Especially throughout the Old Testament, where the Kingdom of Israel and the Israelites are fighting with Babylonians and other groups for the Promised Lands, conquering the city of Jericho, moving from area to area to stay in what God promised to them through Moses and the Exodus from Egypt. And in that case, nationalism for Israel tried to promote them as the Kingdom of God, but their repeated failures to hold onto their territory did not allow them to claim the title of Kingdom of God on earth. And from there, Christianity and Judaism diverge, and Christianity latches on to the Roman Empire with its idea now of a more internationalist flair, as of course Rome conquered different nation states, different areas of the Mediterranean world under their one rule. So territories like Gaul, Britain, North America, Israel, Judea, Greece, Anatolia, of course eventually Turkey, are all under the control of the Roman Empire. Now, they're not all Roman, they are not all on the Italian peninsula. However, Rome controlled each of these different areas. So they all shared a Roman identity while still holding on to their own nationalist identity. And as Christianity grew throughout the Roman Empire, the Roman Catholic Church began to prevail after the Roman Empire even fell, and now the Christian Church started to dominate the state. And it's during this time that the Pope, the leader of the Catholic Church, amassed great earthly power and influence that he kept for most of the next 1,000 years. Now, this shows that through the Middle Ages, even the Renaissance, when there's a move toward humanism, and especially through American colonization and moving through the New World, as the Pope, of course, decreed that the New World would be split initially between Portugal and Spain, before more European countries, such as France, England, and the Netherlands, decided to colonize the areas as well. And this is where we pick up on the theme of the city on a hill with John Winthrop. And then throughout American history, more religious themes come through, such as the Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening, which, spoiler alert, will be a big part of the next episode, so stay tuned for that. And all these other events through American history where people are trying to grapple with the idea of being a nation of Americans that's also a nation of Christians. Are we a Christian nation? Despite the fact that certain colonies at this time, such as New York and even Maryland, were founded with more religious tolerance, either in Maryland's case to protect Catholics as they were under fire in the British Empire, or in the case of New York, as it was New Amsterdam under Dutch control, as an economic center where people literally just went to make money and make a better life. Nobody cared what religion you were, and even under Dutch rule, Peter Stuyvesant tried to control religion and expel certain people of different faiths. The Dutch West India Company told him he had to knock it off, and thus established a little bit more religious freedom within the colony of New Amsterdam, which of course in 1664 became the colony of New York. And clearly we see that nationalism is not a uniquely American problem, but the injection of Christianity into that nationalism has stuck around more in America than it has in any other Western democratic nation. And much of this was born really after World War II, during what we call now the Red Scare and the McCarthy era of U.S. political history. And as the most influential director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover saw his role in protecting American democracy as one that had no cost to great. And Hoover bases his book solely on his own evidence and research as a junior agent in the U.S. government in the 1920s. Hoover titled his book Masters of Deceit. So this tells you what he thought of communism straight off. His research really led him to become the sole authority in his head on the matter of communism. And in the book, what he says goes. Now, not only does this help frame his argument and point of view, but it's also a great insight into how he would run the Bureau for as long as he did during multiple presidencies throughout this era of American history. And much of his evidence comes from the words of William Z. Foster, who was a longtime head of the communist movement in America. In fact, he was chairman of the Communist Party of the United States during Hoover's time at the FBI. And so Hoover summarizes Foster's words and directly quotes him to make sure Americans understand how drastic and dire this situation is. And this is also where Hoover begins to instill fear into Americans over communism. Now, Hoover says in his book, quote, "Fear becomes an enforcement technique. Churches would probably not be closed immediately, but they would be heavily taxed, their property seized by the state, and religious schools liquidated. Clergymen would be required to accept the party line. God does not exist. Why worship him, say the communists? Children would be placed in nurseries and special indoctrination schools." Now, in today's America, many people would consider certain religious schools to be schools of indoctrination as well, but of course, Hoover does not toe that line. Hoover is explicitly using fear of losing religion as a motivating factor for Americans to turn in anybody who is committing any sort of action that could be considered communist or socialist or anything else that looks un-American for that matter. And to further cement his point, he continues to directly quote from Foster when he says, quote, "Likewise, we will be dissolved of all other organizations that are political props of the bourgeois role, including chambers of commerce, employers associations, rotary clubs, American Legion, YMCA, and such fraternal orders as the Masons, Odd Fellows, Elks, Knights of Columbus, etc." Now, two of those organizations, the YMCA, or the Young Men's Christian Association, and the Knights of Columbus, are explicitly Christian. Knights of Columbus Columbus being Catholic. And so by choosing this quote from Foster, Hoover not only shows that there's a chance religion could be eliminated should communists win the Cold War, but that the communists know of these organizations, and this helps Christian men organize to do good Christian acts and be patriotic towards their country. And as a matter of fact, the Knights of Columbus even to this day promote not only religious charity work, but patriotism to their country. And so by targeting the Knights of Columbus, the communists are directly targeting what some could call a nationalist or patriotic organization that also happens to deal with Christianity. Now, of course, Hoover tries to play on these fears, but he's also trying to be hopeful when he closes out this chapter in his book by saying, quote, "But also, thank God, there are millions of Americans who oppose them being the communists. If we open our eyes, inform ourselves, and work together, we can keep our country free, period." Now, of course, one could sit here and proclaim that Hoover is trying to promote freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and all the freedoms that we guarantee through our Constitution, and say that if we work together, we will preserve our Constitution. And that may have been his goal. However, his tactics by trying to inspire people to use more fear of losing their religion and to make people equate saving their religion with saving their country seems to show more through his chapters. And perhaps it's this that makes Hoover's opening claims in his book such a canary in the coal mine for the growth of Christian nationalism within the United States. And this book was published 3 years before Kennedy took office, so that's 3 years before Kennedy referred to the city on a hill in his inspirational speech to the General Court of Massachusetts before taking office. So by today's standards, Hoover would be seen as a conservative, and so this once again helps to prove the theory that conservatives and liberals use religion differently through politics. And as we're going to see in a moment with Barry Goldwater, conservatives do tend to use religion more as a fear tactic and try to unify their party base around this fear, while liberals may use religion for inspiration or philosophy and ignore the theological message. And in 1960, 2 years after Hoover's landmark book was published, Barry Goldwater, another conservative icon, shared his thoughts on American politics. Then a senator from Arizona, Goldwater published his book titled The Conscience of a Conservative, through a ghostwriter, which is now seen as one of the defining works on modern America conservatism. Goldwater launched into a crusade against the big government policies of FDR's New Deal and all the programs meant to bring the country out of the Great Depression, and in his book tried to preach the conservative way and ideology as the only way to bring America forward through the new challenges it would face in this post-World War II era. Now, before getting into what Goldwater said about the conscience of a conservative, I think it's important to look at Chapter 8 of his book, titled The Welfare State, because it helps to bridge the gap between Hoover and Goldwater over those 2 years. Goldwater starts off this chapter by saying, "For many years, it appeared that the principal domestic threat to our freedom was contained in the doctrines of Karl Marx. The collectivists, non-communists, as well as communists, had adopted the Marxist objective of socializing the means of production." And Goldwater goes on to say that this seizing of the means of production would become state-owned production, as in the government would now control the production, and it would control the production of all the goods that we use instead of private industry. And Goldwater goes on to demonize what he calls the welfare state as the new collectivism in America. He rallied against what he called socialism through welfareism by saying, "Welfareism is much more compatible with the political processes of a democratic society. Nationalization ran into popular opposition, but the collectivists feel sure the welfare state can be erected by the simple expedience of buying votes with the promises of free hospitalization, free retirement pay, and so on." He's really going into attacking the entitlements that people get now, talking about unemployment, talking about health care, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Now, of course, debating whether this is free or not is quite interesting, considering it comes out of Americans' payrolls as part of a payroll tax, so it's not really free. It's something that Americans have already paid for, but this seems to be a point that Goldwater and many conservatives don't latch onto when making their arguments against government takeovers of almost every industry.
Goldwater goes on to demonize what he calls the welfare state as the new collectivism in America. Goldwater rallies against what he calls socialism through welfareism. He says welfareism is much more compatible with the political processes of a democratic society. Nationalization ran into popular opposition, but the collectivists feel sure the welfare state can be erected by the simple expedient of buying votes with promises of, quote, free hospitalization, free retirement pay, and so on. And he also says
that the federal budget now allocated much more money to welfare than anything else except for defense. And this is an argument that conservatives still use to this day when discussing the federal deficit, federal budget, the welfare or nanny state, and so on and so forth. We even see today, through the current administration's use of the U.S. DOGE service, Department of Government Efficiency, to try and cut federal spending without raising too much in taxes. Now, through this idea of putting people on the public assistance, it's creating an environment where people will begin to rely too much on the government and will not rely enough on private industry. If this is the case, Goldwater argues that private industry will crumble and that the government will take over all sorts of production and all aspects of people's lives. He asks, why does not such a man instead contribute what he regards as his just share of human welfare to a private charity? He argues money should not be taken from the wealthy or those who work and pay their taxes to pay for those who can't afford anything themselves. If people wanted to help the poor or destitute, they should donate to charity on their own, but keep what is theirs without giving to anybody who is poor or down on their luck. And again, these are very common themes that we see with conservatives even to this day when it comes to fiscal policy, economics, taxation of the wealthy, or lowering taxes across the board versus a more progressive agenda which would tax the wealthy to fund programs for the poor. This argument really hasn't changed much since the 1960s. And through this chapter, Goldwater clearly argues that any sort of a welfare state becomes a nanny state, and that the more people depend on the government for any sort of assistance, Social Security, the Great Society, which Goldwater is rallying against, which gave us, like I said before, Medicare, Medicaid, disability pay, all of these things that Americans have grown to not only depend on but expect today, that it would create a burden for those who carry the weight of the taxpayers. Welfare is too socialist for a capitalist society. Again, a hardworking man or woman goes out, works 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, tries to afford to buy things for their family, food, you need a car, you need to pay the bills at home, pay a mortgage. Why should more of my money be taken in taxes for people that can't afford to do it themselves? You know, pull yourself by the bootstraps. And of course, in the 1960s, this is a really big attitude, especially when people were benefiting from programs like the GI Bill after World War II, and of course, a lot of government spending and housing policy coming out, new laws being passed to allow people to buy homes. Of course, there are other issues we can go into in a different podcast, such as who benefited from that, the red line crises, all throughout urban areas. But that's a discussion for a different podcast. But back to the 60s, Goldwater was not the only person rallying against a welfare state and using Christian themes to build a base of supporters. An actor in California was beginning his political career and campaigning for Goldwater in 1964. Eventually, this man ran for governor of California and president of the United States by 1980. Of course, this man was Ronald Reagan. And in a speech now known as A Time of Choosing in 1964, Reagan made a direct pitch to people about reining in big government. He told the crowd, "No government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size. So, government's programs, once launched, never disappear. Actually, a government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth." Now, this might just be a passing reference to a Christian concept of heaven or an eternal life, but it appeals directly to many voters who feel as if the government is too intrusive, too large, and way too involved in the lives of everyday Americans. It also promotes an idea that is not solely Christian, but is very closely aligned with Christian values. Reagan is definitely a student of political history, looking at references made to Christianity by people like Goldwater, and he knows he's appealing to those supporters by bringing up their faith. If he's going to capture the hearts and minds of these conservatives, he needs to appeal directly to their souls, just as Goldwater did with his book. And he goes on in different speeches to decry the immorality of California college campuses, speaking about extreme sexuality and drug use, and the protesting of government policies, including the war in Vietnam. Now, many of these behaviors would be seen as something like an immoral debauchery by Christians, especially those who are on the conservative ends of the Christian spectrum. And the idea that these universities are receiving public funding and should therefore curtail what happens there to create a more moral atmosphere of higher learning foreshadows the opening of universities in America by evangelical Christians that promote a lifestyle such as this. And it even invokes the Mormon revival at Brigham Young University in Utah, with its morality code that governs students to live lives of that faith. And as private universities, they do have the right to require students to adhere to those standards. However, in a public university, such as the University of California system that Reagan rallied against, many constitutional freedoms, including freedom of religion or freedom to not practice religion and to live by someone else's moral code, are under attack. This will become a theme of Christian nationalism, where people who subscribe to this political theory believe that all should be living a Christian moral lifestyle, whether they choose to or not. And of course, this is one of the great ironies of using freedom of religion to defend the Christian faith and have people believe and promote values that align with the Christian faith because they are Christian. But America's founders, as we saw from Jefferson and from the Constitution, did not believe this to be the case. And this, of course, is the one big difference between Christian nationalists and constitutional scholars, that there is no Christian influence in the Constitution. However, as people went backwards in history, they found these ideas within the document that they believed to be Christian and decided to sort of revisionist history style make it out as if the founders were promoting absolute Christianity over every other religion. Now, all of this is being said during a political climate which can be called contentious, to put it nicely, and bordering on civil war, to be extreme. And depending on who you asked, you would get an answer on that spectrum, or quite possibly somewhere I haven't even been able to describe to you. Now, going back to James Wood in his landmark article, he continues to discuss the idea of Christianity not even fitting in with the idea of nationalism. And this is interesting to think about, because we're seeing through this episode the idea of Christian values being fused into American nationalism. This is a time where we're fighting a Cold War and we're not physically going against the Soviet Union, but we are in proxy wars, the longest and most dragged out one, of course, being Vietnam, but also Korea before that. And we'll see conflict in Afghanistan and other conflicts all throughout the world where America will insert itself into the domestic policies of foreign nations to install pro-America leaders. These events, of course, started with Truman's containment policy, followed through Eisenhower's presidency into the Kennedy administration, which is sort of where we pick up this episode in a post-Kennedy world where Goldwater is running against his successor, Lyndon Johnson. You know, in history, a lot of what America does is looked at through not only a political lens, but a moral and spiritual lens. And Wood brings up that Eisenhower's campaigns in the 1950s are being built on these moral and spiritual exercises that are to bring America to a higher status. And in fact, they could even bring America to perpetual greatness. You know, this could only be done by believing in American values and promoting the American values that we love throughout the entire world. Now, this greatly influences American foreign policy through the latter half of the 20th century and brings us into the post-Cold War era, where the ideas of morality and spirituality become even more intertwined with American politics. This especially happens with the conservative parties, mostly the Republican Party, on the American political spectrum. And yeah, this kind of goes back and forth and yo-yos throughout history between different presidencies and different administrations. A lot of times we think of Eisenhower as warning us against the military-industrial complex and having the I Like Ike campaign ads in cartoons. You know, the I Like Ike buttons for the people to wear is sort of the beginning of innocent political campaigning, when really Eisenhower was using faith and using religious undertones to make people believe that America was facing a great moral crisis that it needed to solve. And of course, when we face a great moral crisis, many people in our country turn to a religion for their sense of morality, and since most people in America at the time were, and still to are today, Christian, they lean on that faith to help guide them. And Wood's interpretation of Christianity probably stays more true to its intent to not be a political force, where he even references Jesus Christ as saying that his kingdom is not of this earth. Christianity is not meant to be an earthly power or an earthly kingdom. The message throughout the New Testament explains that God's kingdom is not of the earth, and if God's kingdom is not of the earth, you could argue there is no possible way that Christianity and nationalism could coexist. Now, this is a point that many people fail to understand, and as conservatives and conservatism and Christianity began to blend into one political theory, Wood said that nationalism was a denial of the universalism that God created, and therefore, how can Christianity, which is supposed to be universal in nature, including the word Catholic, which does mean universal, how can a church made for everybody throughout the entire universe, if not on this planet, then promote the ideals of one nation under the banner of nationalism? Theologically speaking, if the Christian God had decided to take over the world for himself, he could very easily transform all nations into Christian nations. However, the Christian faith, especially the Catholic faith, which holds the most Christians in the world at about 1.4 billion people, at least in terms of people they say are baptized into the faith, these Christian faiths believe in the doctrine of free will, which of course also very similarly lines up with our American Bill of Rights to have certain freedoms. Now, the idea of free will in the church is more of a free will to do as you choose, while you should be choosing to do what God's will would be, and of course that's a tenet of Christian faith throughout all of history. In America, with our Bill of Rights and our Constitution, people are given the right to see and do as they see fit within their lives, as long as they don't run afoul of that Constitution. Now, of course, this is very similar to how people in the Christian Bible choose to follow their faith on their own path, but still try to stay aligned with what's in the Bible or Scripture, let's say the Ten Commandments or the Beatitudes, for instance. And this is exactly what I was talking about before when I mentioned how people look back in history and see connections between Christianity and American politics and government and make those connections even though they were not there in the first place. Of course, the great irony with this idea of Christian nationalism is that people are trying to force a faith on others that is not theirs, or if not force their faith on them, then force them to live their lives in accordance with that faith or to a moral code based solely in that faith. If anything, American life should be governed by Enlightenment philosophies, considering that was more of an influence on our founders and their moral codes than they carried with them, since they were much more into intellectual thinking than they were into what we would today call actual faith. And Wood rebuked people who believed that this sort of Christian nationalism would be pleasing to the Christian God when he ended his article by saying, "The Christian ought never forget that it was a misguided nationalism, along with a sense of racial superiority and religious bigotry, which identified the Kingdom of Israel with the Kingdom of God, and directly contributed to the crucifixion of Jesus. For the mission of Jesus was not that of a national Messiah, but the Savior of all mankind. Meanwhile, the transnational character of the church ought to symbolize the need for the state to understand its own national future in terms of an emerging world community in which churches and states seek to contribute to the needs of mankind as members of a world family." It certainly flies in the face of what Hoover, Goldwater, and Reagan all tried to promote through their speeches, and certainly is a canary in the coal mine for what else is to come throughout American history, especially through the 1970s and 1980s. Before jumping into those decades in the next episode, though, it's definitely worth looking back at what Catherine Stewart discussed about the idea of a strong man being necessary to fix the problems of a nation. Now, Stewart described exactly how the Israelites in the Bible felt their Messiah would be. Stewart, of course, is a journalist whose focus on religious nationalism and its rise gives her really good background and authority on this topic. And so she talks about the great disappointment for them of Jesus of Nazareth not being this sort of Messiah. And of course, what Wood would argue is a basis for their nationalism and bigotry against someone like Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth was not the strong man the Israelites wanted. Throughout the Old Testament, one can read about the struggles of Israel trying to rule over itself. You know, Israel is constantly conquered. Israel is constantly fighting for its freedom. Israel runs away from Egypt and enslavement along the Nile River. Israel eventually becomes its own kingdom, but is conquered by the Babylonians, is conquered by many different people, and eventually this leads to the spreading of the Jewish diaspora throughout the entire world. You want to go back 2,000 years to the time of Christ? The Israelites are trying to break free from Roman rule and believe their Messiah is going to be somebody who will take up arms and expel the Roman Empire from Israel and Judea and give them back the kingdom they had when David and Solomon were alive. So the idea of a messianic savior to bring a nation out of turmoil and into glory has existed for thousands of years. This is nothing new throughout global history. It's just being seen in America on a scale that's truly unseen throughout global history. And as we get into later episodes, we'll begin to see how the idea of the strong man in the executive office of the United States becomes more appealing to conservatives and even leads into the elections over the past 8 to 12 years in American history, culminating in Donald Trump's second term as president. And we'll look at the comparisons made between him and other strongman leaders around the world. And of course, by looking for a strong man to defeat the enemies, it flies in the face of everything Christian doctrine says about loving enemies, taking care of your neighbor, turning the other cheek, humility and mercy in life to recognize your own faults and the faults of others, and of course, to forgive others for their mistakes. When it comes to Christian nationalism, we're going to see an evolution to where everyone else is making mistakes, and it's up to America to solve those mistakes through policies designed to promote Christian values and to impart these Christian values on its citizens, whether they asked for it or not. Now, there's one word I'm definitely going to repeat a lot throughout this podcast series, and it's definitely the word ironic or ironically or any form of that word. Goldwater himself in his 1964 acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention gives us a sense of that irony, of the irony of Christian nationalism, and the irony that develops as movement itself develops. We still get an idea of small government Republicans wanting to break down a large government, a bloated government, a nanny state, a welfare state, as much as Republicans today express a desire to do so. One key difference that has evolved over time has to do with the idea of absolute power being in one section of the government. As he accepts the nomination, Goldwater says, "Those who seek to live your lives for you, to take your liberties in return for relieving you of yours, those who elevate the state and downgrade the citizen, must see ultimately a world in which earthly power can be substituted for divine will. And this nation was founded upon the rejection of that notion and upon the acceptance of God as the author of freedom. Those who seek absolute power, even though they seek it to do what they regard as good, are simply demanding the right to enforce their own version of heaven on earth. And let me remind you, they are the very ones who always create the most hellish tyrannies. Absolute power does corrupt, and those who seek it must be suspect and must be opposed." Goldwater is still insisting that the New Deal and Great Society create a federal government that bordered on tyrannical, and insisted that conservative politics and small government would be the cure to this disease infecting American politics. Reagan jumped on this idea, eventually won the presidency in 1980, thanks to his work in California, his adoption of Goldwater's policies, and hyperinflation caused by a lot of Jimmy Carter's inability to run a successful domestic campaign as president, despite his incredible achievements in foreign policy. Goldwater is telling Republicans who have nominated him and Americans around the country that the nation was founded upon the acceptance of God as the author of freedom, when clearly this is not true. Goldwater rejects Kennedy's interpretation of history, which clearly was rooted in facts, and directly referenced founders and their beliefs when writing the Constitution in favor of continuing to inject Christianity into the American political theater. Even his reference to divine will substituting for earthly power flies in the face of what James Wood argued in his article, which, while criminally underrated, has stood the test of time. Of course, his assertion that absolute power will corrupt absolutely, which goes as far back into global political history and gets referenced on nearly every high school level state history exam or AP exam, is something everyone remembers in class, compared with something like mitochondria being the powerhouse of the cell.
Goldwater says the ones who seek absolute power are trying to enforce their own version of heaven on earth. And of course, Christian nationalists are trying to enforce their idea of heaven on earth and make earth into their heaven, despite what others want and what their free will dictates they should be allowed to do with their lives. For those who are not Christian or those who prefer a secular government, you know, the idea of a Christian nationalist government is probably quite hellish to them, or quite possibly even this hellish tyranny Goldwater was rife to claim life under the Great Society would be, and life under a large liberal government with welfare handouts is. It's a very simple take. It's a very easy take to make. It's not quite as intellectual as other points Goldwater made in Conscience of a Conservative and other speeches that he gave, but the simplest messages are often the ones that get across to people the most. And of course, for Goldwater, preaching this point of view did not put him in the White House, but it did inspire others to continue the cause and to promote it throughout the late 20th century. Christian nationalism should dictate the future of the United States, and it does for conservatives as we move into the 70s, 80s, and late 20th, early 21st century. Now, as the 1960s came to a close, we saw an incredible number of events happen in the history of the United States that shaped the next 20 years to come. Assassinations of JFK, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, these all had incredible and lasting impacts on every American. These deaths were tragic. In some cases, they were brutal. And because of that, they ended up being used politically to motivate Americans to vote. And how they voted was based on what side of the issue they were on. You know, the number of protests increased, how they decided to handle issues like the Vietnam War, the Great Society, where people stood on those sides of the issues, changed radically throughout the 1960s, especially through 1968. It was that year when Richard Nixon was elected because of his response and plan to help bring America back to some sort of normalcy after what can only be described as an incredibly difficult year in American history. Of course, with Johnson stepping down in 1968, Reagan also did not have a strong candidate to run against, and so many of these events had Americans searching for security and searching for answers, and many of them ended up turning back to, knowingly or not, the words of Goldwater and heard the voice of Ronald Reagan calling for more order in the country. Now, they heard Richard Nixon reference the silent majority in denouncing Vietnam War protesters throughout his presidency, and they heard others outside the political world preaching about the idea of America being Christian and the idea of returning to a sense of morality, and of course a sense of Christian morality, and the idea that following in those footsteps, that would be the only way to protect America and return it to the prominence that it once held. In a way, returning to Christianity or moral Christianity or even turning to Christian nationalism would quite possibly make America great again. I think you can see where we're going with this podcast series. So it's here we stop the story for now, and it's there where we're going to pick it up on our next episode. Now, if you haven't already done this, make sure you subscribe to the podcast and our YouTube channel. Check us out again on TikTok and Instagram, That History Teacher. And stay tuned for our next episode where we look at the 1970s and 80s and how Christian nationalism sprouted from the seeds planted by Hoover, Goldwater, and Reagan and the social issues of the 1960s, and how people like Ronald Reagan, Jerry Falwell, and Billy Graham helped to cultivate those little sprouts into bigger trees, which ended up sprouting throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. And you know what that means. There's going to be a part three also, guys. And we're going to look at the 1990s to the present day, see how Christian nationalism grew from those cultivated seeds planted, and how, in some ways, we reached the political moment where we are today. So I really hope you've enjoyed this Origins of Christian Nationalism podcast episode. Of course, looking at current events through a historical and political lens will definitely help us to continue to understand more about our present day situations. Looking into the past helps us to see the future if we can make certain changes in the present. Once again, I am Pete Stam, That History Teacher. TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, check us out. Apple, Spotify, anywhere you find podcasts, you're going to find us. Be well. Stay tuned. See you in the next episode.